Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's no making sense of Boston. You almost can't try. What you can do, though, if you run a small business, is try to help that city come back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 16th of April. Glad, as always, to have you with us. Even in the best of times, it's easy to be cynical about business. You know, it's all about money and profits and getting ahead. But then after something like happened in Boston yesterday, you try to take a step back and remember that at some level, business is about something else. It's about community and people and getting by. Marketplace's Mark Garrison is in Boston for us today.
Dozens of Boston blocks are locked down so investigators can pick over potential evidence. Just outside the police barricades is a row of stores on Massachusetts Avenue. One is a flower shop called Fern, where employee Crystal Cobb Collier is sweeping up and recalling yesterday's events.
We see a rush of people coming down Mass Ave, and we were like, something's not right, because this many people would not leave the race.
She could see both people fleeing the blast and others running toward the site to help. Staffers weren't sure if their street would be accessible today, but once they knew it would open, the owner decided the store would too.
And it's been slow. It's been a slow morning. I think it's still kind of, everybody's in shock.
So why fight through blocked off streets in a transit nightmare to open up? In part, to be there for transactions without words or money. Like this one today, when a quiet man dressed in his marathon jacket stepped in.
He came in and just smelled the flowers. I guess he was just taking in that moment to thank God he made it through another day. So I didn't say anything. I just kind of let him, you know, take that moment.
A florist is a rare kind of business that serves people at their most joyous and darkest moments. The attacks turned one into the other. Flowers that might have graced bouquets for triumphant runners now await service in a memorial arrangement. Mass Avenue connects with Boylston Street, where the bombs exploded. But just beyond that is the eclectic shopping of Newbury Street and another business that opened today.
We do have it in stock. It can't be done today for obvious reasons.
Howie Rubin is general manager for Bauer Wine and Spirits, a business dating to the mid-60s. Normally, he can count on lots of popping corks after the marathon.
They're not celebrating. I don't think we're going to sell any champagne for a while.
Just a block off the blast site, Newbury Street wasn't guaranteed to be accessible today. But once Rubin found out it was, he decided to open.
You got to get life back to normal after something like that. And just to go about your daily routine and go to your stores and go to your coffee shops. People do want to get together with their friends and try and resume life as they knew it as quickly as they can.
He unlocked his door so that people can choose to have a drink as they talk out their feelings with friends. Back at the flower shop, Collier talked about the impact of being there for those in challenging times.
Being around all these living things helped.
And living people. Offering an open door and a human connection to those in difficulty is what drove many small business owners to work today. In Boston, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
After the explosions of yesterday come the investigations. President Obama has said authorities will, quote, follow every lead. Mayor Tom Menino of Boston reminded the public today that no piece of information or detail is too small. But in an age of surveillance cameras on nearly every block and cell phone cameras in nearly every pocket, how are investigators actually going to wade through all that possibly helpful video they're going to get? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has that story.
Almost as soon as the bombs went off, social media sites were full of fragments of the tragedy that people had captured on their cell phones.
Yeah, look, fire trucks are coming through the race right now.
Oh, my God.
But it's not just dramatic footage like this that could help investigators.
As important is a video 5 minutes before the explosion two blocks away.
Angelo Guarino is president of Ocean Systems, a company that develops forensic video technology. He says while someone was waving "Hi, Mom" at the camera, a person that investigators have connected to the attack might have been walking by.
And that might be where they get the best image.
Investigators will gather thousands of hours of video from cell phones and store security cameras and ATM and traffic light cameras. But it's on hundreds of different formats, so just collecting it all into one system will be tough. Guarino says the usual ways we share videos, over YouTube or on a DVD, compress the files to make them easier to send.
That means throwing data away. That means throwing evidence away. It could be down to a pixel.
Once all that video is gathered with special software, it goes to a place like the Digital Multimedia Evidence Processing Lab at the University of Indianapolis. There, someone like Grant Fredericks, a forensic video expert, wades through all of it, frame by frame, tagging everything, trying to make connections.
Clothing descriptions and hat descriptions and backpack descriptions and shoes descriptions, those codes are then cross-referenced. And then you can track an individual throughout the city.
But is all this effort really worth it? I asked Fredericks what the odds were that the person who planted the bombs would have actually been caught on video yesterday.
100% likely, probably 100 times.
I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The road racing calendar shifts to London now for next Sunday's London Marathon. The British capital does know way too much about terrorist attacks, and race organizers say they are reassessing security. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
It's the world's biggest marathon. 500,000 people are expected to line the route, watching 36,000 runners. Hannah Carter, one of the competitors, says after the Boston bombs, it's difficult not to feel a bit of a target.
It makes you, makes you do a double take on the whole thing, and I just pray that everybody will be safe.
The government insists the London Marathon will be totally safe. The UK spent $1 billion on security at last year's Olympic Games, which included a marathon. Jennifer Cole is a terrorism expert at the Royal United Services Institute. She says London can still draw on some of the fruits of that investment.
The technology, things like CCTV cameras and the software that can automatically recognise odd behaviour in crowds, is still state of the art.
And she points out London is already bristling with security personnel. Soldiers have been out rehearsing for tomorrow's funeral of Margaret Thatcher. This $13 million affair entails heightened security, which is likely to be extended to cover the marathon.
There are personnel around, there are processes in place that are going to be very easy to just carry on over into the weekend.
But Peter Lear, a lecturer in terrorism studies at St Andrews University, is not totally reassured, however much money the government throws into protecting the marathon.
Guaranteeing a complete and absolutely secure environment, I think that's impossible.
Of course, he says, you could stage the race inside Wembley Stadium and have the competitors running round and round behind locked doors and without any spectators, but then the only winner would be terrorism. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street was a bright spot today, led by housing and corporate profits, near as I can tell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Travel is romantic, right? Adventurous and exciting. Well, I pose it as a question, but really, it's not. Travel is exciting and adventurous. It is also, however, big business, global in the truly global sense of the word. Elizabeth Becker explores the business behind the travel industry in her new book. It's called Overbooked. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
So I have to tell you, this interview comes at an opportune time because I am spending most of my week on airplanes and the phrase overbooked springs prominently to mind.
Good.
Yeah. It's a joke, but it's not far from the truth, right? Travel and tourism is all the rage these days.
It's not only the rage, it is one of the world's biggest industries. And I'm setting out to try to take this and make it a serious discussion of the huge industry of tourism.
Give us a sense. How big?
Well, one out of 11 people is employed by tourism.
Wow.
About $3 billion a day is spent on tourism. It is the second only to the energy field for the strategy of poor countries to climb out of their poverty.
Let's talk about infrastructure for a second, though, because cruise ships, they bring, 6,000 people or whatever it is to a tiny city, not to mention all the footprints on the Great Pyramids and Petra and Syria and all that stuff. I mean, it's not all sunshine and light.
No, you're absolutely right. And you can see the schizophrenia where the local government wants to make money, but then they're seeing the incredible destruction caused by all these. It's not just 6,000 passengers from a cruise ship, sometimes it's 10,000, 12,000 when there are, you know, four and five lined up. And they drain the services, and they don't give, often they don't give much back to the local economy. And governments are trying to figure out what they call sacrifice zones.
No,
and that
really?
Would be,
like giving up these zones to the tourists?
Yeah, like in Belize, for instance, I took a cruise there. And they have one section of a sort of a wildlife preserve where tourists can go and where they sort of gently push them. And then they keep them away from the others.
I imagine there's a list of usual suspects when it comes to the most impactful tourists. Americans have to be on that list, right? Who else?
Our reputation is getting better.
Oh, is it really? Oh, thank goodness. Because I have memories of sitting in a cafe in Paris, sitting next to the quintessentially ugly American and literally hiding my head.
No, I was in fact greeted with, oh, an American.
Oh, thank
great.
God.
Welcome back.
That's great.
The big tourist surge is coming from China.
Yeah, it makes sense.
By 2020, the Chinese will represent the biggest number of tourists in the world. One of my favorite quotes is, the statistics, excuse me, is that in 2009, more Chinese visited Paris than all of the United States.
Wow, that's crazy.
So the French have Chinese interpreters at the department stores. They're encouraging Franco-Chinese chefs and trying to figure out how to make the cultures match and figure out where the Chinese would be happiest visiting France.
Tell me about your mom and how this sort of became a personal thing for you.
Well, my mother had a wonderful but rather smaller life, and she'd never traveled. And after my father died, she looked around and said, I think I'm going to sell the house and start traveling. And before she died, she went to every continent but Antarctica.
Wow.
And it made her so happy. And that's one of those stories that explains why tourism is such a pull. And I wanted people to remember that when they're reading my book, but also to see that tourism is the typical double-edged sword where it can bring so much pleasure but so much destruction.
Elizabeth Becker, formerly of the New York Times and National Public Radio, she's got a new book out. It's called Overbooked, The Exploding Business of Travel and Tourism. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, the first one's always free, you know.
Is this a ploy that McDonald's is using in creating a whole new generation of consumers that will become brand loyal specific to McDonald's?
Yeah, maybe. But first, let's do the numbers. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the rebound after a nosedive yesterday. The Dow Industrial snapped back 157 points, about 1%, closed at 14,756. The NASDAQ up 48 points, 1.5%, 3264 at the bell. The S&P 500 bumped up 22 points, about 1.3%, wrapped up the day at 1574. The Dow got a jolt from, among other components, the Coca-Cola Company. The makers of The Real Thing released better-than-expected earnings, and thirsty investors floated shares 5.5% higher. I'm a root beer float guy myself. All right, now a little game for you. Goldman Sachs released better-than-expected profits today. The stock rose, yes? No, lost nearly 1.2%. Seems investors are worried Goldman isn't making enough from trading. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/TheBigBook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. Sold your stuff recently? Garage sale or eBay? The company releases quarterly earnings. And in Champaign, Illinois, Ebert Fest gets underway. The annual film festival goes on in the absence of its beloved founder, the late Roger Ebert. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's a dirty business, you know, growing an economy. We went through it here during the Industrial Revolution. The Chinese are going through it now. The air pollution over there that you've heard about or seen pictures of probably the past couple of months, that's in the cities. mostly. But out in the countryside, water is arguably a bigger problem. The water that irrigates the crops that feed China's 1.3 billion people and that is commonly used as a toxic dumping ground. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has more now on China's toxic harvest.
The 300-million-pound hill of chemical waste beside farmer Wu Shuliang's rice paddy began to take shape in the 1990s. It was yellow and green, and it smelled terrible. The waste was from a factory next door, a byproduct from making chemicals used for tanning leather.
Whenever it rained, our rice paddy in the river would suddenly turn bright yellow. Much of my rice was lost. It killed everything in its path.
Around the time the hill began to form, Wu and his wife had two sons. They grew up bathing in the river that turned yellow when it rained. They breathed the dust that blew off of the hill on windy days. And the oldest son, Wu Wenyong, spent much of his childhood working the rice paddies in the hill's shadow. When he was 14, Wu Wenyong began having health problems. He couldn't stop coughing. He had difficulty breathing and his chest hurt, says his mother, Qi Xianyi.
We heard on the local news that this hill might be harmful to our health. So we took our son to the hospital and asked the doctor whether it had anything to do with his health problems. The doctor didn't say anything. He just shook his head.
This was in 2011. At the time, the environmental NGO Greenpeace traveled to Wu's village here in rural Yunnan province to run water tests. The samples were high in chromium-6, a known carcinogen. One water sample from Wu's land showed the level of chromium-6 was 240 times higher than what China and the U.S. allow in their drinking water.
I would say that's startlingly high.
UC Davis researcher Peter Green studies chromium's impact on water.
Although some people can detoxify some amount of it, the amounts you mention are very, very high, and it's, to me, not plausible that that could be detoxified by anyone.
Wu Wenyong was in eighth grade when he was diagnosed with two types of cancer, leukemia and thymoma. The doctor handed over the diagnosis report to the 14-year-old. Neither his father nor his mother can read.
We didn't understand what was going on. But as my son read the diagnosis, he seemed to understand how severe his cancer was. He had the strength to smile. He told me, "Mom, don't cry. I won't be around to help farm the land anymore, but Dad will help you. It'll be all right."
She and her husband borrowed thousands of dollars from family and sold all of their cattle and sheep, everything they owned, to pay for Wu's chemotherapy.
It didn't work. He would wake up with foam all over his mouth and he couldn't settle down. He was in so much pain. He finally asked me to open the window. He said, "Just let me jump, Mom."
On February 16th, 2012, Wu Wenyong died in his hospital bed. He was 15.
There are a lot of such sad stories of pollution victims all over China.
Ma Tianjie works for Greenpeace China. In a recent trip to Xinglong, the village where the Wu family lives, Ma found at least 30 other villagers among 500 who had been diagnosed with cancer. Even the government has started referring to these places as cancer villages. Officials are worried because villages like these supply China with its food.
I think the implications are significant. A lot of those heavy metals will be accumulated in food crops grown nearby the pollution site.
5 years ago, a soil survey taken from rice in three of China's largest agricultural provinces shocked Chinese consumers. 60% of the rice samples showed excessive amounts of cadmium, a heavy metal that causes bone and kidney damage. At the time, Chinese scientists openly discussed the widespread contamination of China's food supply. But these days, they're not talking. Several scientists declined interviews with Marketplace. That's because late last year, China's Communist Party declared national soil surveys state secrets. Revealing China's state secrets can send you to prison. American scientist Peter Green says in the case of chromium-6, which polluted the soil in Xinglong Village, it's undoubtedly been absorbed by the rice grown there.
That's unfortunate, because then it can get into the food chain and be eaten either by humans or perhaps other animals, depending on the plant.
Back in Xinglong Village, the 300-million-pound hill of chromium-6 waste is now gone. The company that created it, Luliang Peace Technology, removed the waste a few months ago. But farmer Wu Shilang says his well water is still contaminated. He grabs a 10-foot-long stick and dips it down into the well. When he pulls it up, the end of the stick is covered with a thick mustard-yellow chemical sludge. Neither Luliang Peace Technology nor the local government agreed to an interview with Marketplace. Farmers Qi Xianyi and Wu Shiliang still grow rice in the yellow-contaminated water they pump from their well. Their family doesn't dare eat it. Instead, they sell it to others.
We don't have a choice. We lost all our money paying the medical bills for our son. We know the rice is dangerous, so we sell it to other provinces in China.
And those vendors sell this contaminated rice throughout China. The situation seems hopeless, but lately there have been encouraging developments. A week ago, a top official of China's Ministry of the Environment said the soil survey, currently deemed a state secret, will soon be released to the public. And a local judge has agreed to review the case of Luliang Peace Technology's contamination of Xinglong Village, opening up the possibility that millions of dollars would be set aside for villagers. But Qi says the ruling may come too late for her family. Her 12-year-old son has recently developed a chronic cough, just like his brother before he got cancer. The problem is, says Qi, her family has so much debt from treating her first son's cancer that now they can't afford to bring their remaining son to the doctor for help. In Xinglong Village, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
Rob's series continues online and on our morning show with a map of some of China's toxic villages, videos and pictures of some of that toxic waste as well. It's at marketplace.org. From the American real estate market, this news today, housing starts, that is, just like it sounds, the number of homes on which ground was broken last month has hit its highest level since 2008. If the pace keeps up, it'll be a million new homes by the end of the year, which is a whole lot of homes. So what kind of houses do consumers want and what kinds are builders building? Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
So where are consumers spending when they're building their new houses?
They are spending a lot of money in the kitchen and in the master bath.
Kira Sterling is chief marketing officer for Toll Brothers, a custom home builder.
Like man caves, cathedral ceilings, additional bedrooms and bathrooms.
And possibly my favorite feature, the bonus room. Extra space in your house for whatever you want.
They are a little bit bigger than before the recession. They're particularly bigger than during the recession.
David Crow is chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. He says the average size of homes fell during the recession, but now it's picking up again.
But that has more to do with the fact that only those with very good credit ratings and employment histories can purchase right now, can get a mortgage.
Crow says while single-family home construction is up over last year, the rise in housing building is really due to new apartments. Younger workers often don't have cash for a mortgage. But for those who can afford a brand new home, there's a new trend, smaller houses in a more urban area. That's according to Susan Wachter. She teaches real estate and finance at Wharton.
There is an actual increase in demand for city living, for being closer to transit, or less commuting.
Wachter also says for those buying homes on smaller lots, it's because land prices are coming back strong. From my rented New York City apartment, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Tens of thousands of kids in Arizona got a free breakfast today courtesy of McDonald's. Franchise owners in a handful of states have gotten together to give away food on days that schools administer big standardized tests. And yes, it is tough to take a test on an empty stomach, but come on. Seriously? Corporate generosity or good advertising? From Phoenix, Marketplace's Peter O'Dowd has that story.
It takes some effort to squeeze through the front door at this crowded Central Phoenix McDonald's.
I suspect that we'll serve over 500 students this morning just in this restaurant alone.
Franchise operator Jerry Gerke spends $2 a head on each student's Egg McMuffin, a pack of apple slices, and a milk. He says it's good for the kids. They need brain food to ace the state's standardized test. The free breakfast also builds loyalty for moms like Naomi Quintero, who eats here with her family every weekend.
It does. It makes me feel like, oh my God, after so much money being spent here, I finally get something back.
Quintero's sons will each get about 18 grams of protein in their egg sandwich. Nutritionist Simeen Levinson says that's pretty good fuel for a test.
I would consider it to be a well-rounded meal.
But it's certainly not the only place to get one. At the nearby Creighton School District, 4,700 students eat a free breakfast every day. Their families are poor enough to qualify for subsidized meals. Levinson says these meals are nutritionally similar to the free McDonald's menu, but if she had a choice, she'd take the one that's free of corporate influence.
This is where I can't help but be a little bit skeptical. Is this a ploy that McDonald's is using in creating a whole new generation of consumers that will become brand loyal specific to McDonald's?
That worries Levinson. She says the next time those 500 kids are in line, they're likely to choose something that's loaded with fat and sodium. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out this Tuesday, some odds and ends we didn't get to elsewhere. Item number one, American Airlines, a very rough day for them. They were grounded, flying not a single plane for about 4 hours today. A computer glitch in the reservations system of all places forced them to cancel 400 some odd flights. Item number two, also not a good day for economists Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. If you recognize those names, it's because they wrote a very high-profile paper and book a couple of years ago showing, they said, that countries with a lot of debt grow really, really slowly. Kind of became the guidebook for people who want more government austerity. Told you that so I could tell you this. A different paper out today says the Rogoff-Reinhart analysis doesn't hold up because, and here's the great part, they missed a column in their Excel spreadsheet. Economists being economists, there's a rebuttal coming soon, I'm sure. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gained 157 points, 1%. The NASDAQ jumped 48 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500 surged 21 points, 1.3%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, Lina Anwar, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.